So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight.
Listen to review
me. Right now, right? That's what you say. We get it by now.
Your reality is you're a B-plus player.
I didn't mind being called a B-plus player. It's interesting because I feel like a lot of that is very legitimate thoughts about me that people within the WWE had at the time and still have about me. As far as like, okay, yes, he gets a really good crowd reaction. Yes, the fans like him, but the fans that like me are the fans that are going to come to the show regardless. He is not going to bring in like the casual viewer the way The Rock did or the way John Cena does or anything like that. And so it's exactly what they said. Oh yeah, he's good. We all recognize that he's good, and yes, he's popular, and he'll sell us some t-shirts, and he's, you know, good for business in his limited role, but as far as being, like, the guy that we want to put on magazine covers and all that kind of stuff, he's not that guy. He's, you know, and if we are grading people from an F to an A+, yeah, he's about a B+. It's never bothered me what anybody else says about me. I've faced that my entire career. Oh, you're too small, you're too this, you're too that. Even in Ring of Honor, like, when they put the title on me, they had to. They had nobody else. And so that's kind of been my thing my whole career, and things just pan out. I can't explain it.
You say yes, I say no. You say stop, I say go, go, go. Oh no, you say goodbye, I say hello.
Welcome to Review Away, I'm John Pollock, and this week we've got Wei Ting on the program, as always.
Just this week.
Just this week.
Yeah.
You know, you never know when you might disappear and go somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
How are you? How's your iced coffee?
Great. Delicious.
You and I, that's our difference. It's the yin and the yang, the cold beverage and the warm beverage, but we're unified by Tim Hortons.
That's right. That's like
same tree, different branches.
Yeah, it's an interesting branch of Buddhism, the Tim Hortons branch of Buddhism.
Yeah, I had a nice conversation with this guy. He took my order, and then he just kind of said, how are you doing? And I said, I'm doing great. He's like, how was your weekend? I'm like, my weekend was pretty good. The weather was nice.
Who is this, the person behind the counter?
Yeah, who else would
oh,
it be?
God. And I never enter conversations.
This guy always does, this one guy. And then he was saying how I wish I could say my weekend was better. And he's like just begging me for to ask. And I didn't say anything. So then he took it upon himself to just say how he had to work all weekend.
You actually said all this to that guy?
He said
one guy?
No, he said all this to me. I was just responding to him.
Okay.
And he was telling me, I wish I could say my weekend was better.
Why was his weekend so bad?
Well, I just say he had to work all weekend, he said.
Oh.
So he was stuck inside serving double doubles.
What are you supposed to say to that?
I said, my response was actually, yeah. Weekends can be tough with work. What do you say to that? I'm like, okay, your weekend wasn't great. You had to work. You made some money.
Why would he inconvenience you like that?
I'm sure it's encouraged to engage the customer with some
maybe you just
witty
have a,
conversation.
Maybe you just have a face that people want to talk to.
Yeah, maybe.
You know? Like somebody sees you and they're just like, I'm just going to
come up and talk to you.
Tell them about my woes.
I'm fine with that. My biggest pet peeve is when I'm out and about and I've always got my headphones on. And if someone comes up, a random person, and just starts talking to me, like asking for directions or, God damn, is it going to rain tomorrow? I don't know. They come up with a random question. It's like, I got my headphones on. It's like, to me, in 2015, that's a space that you do not cross.
I'd say in any decade, any year, mm-hmm. if you have headphones on, you probably shouldn't be talking to that person.
I remember CM Punk once sharing a story, I think it was on Colt Cabana's show, about how a fan would come up and yank the earbud out to ask him for an autograph or something. I can't imagine something that would infuriate me more than if you were to yank my earbud out of my ear. Like, do you ever have that with
That's assault. That's like harassment.
You have opened yourself up to whatever this man responds with is valid. Like, have you ever had your headphone get connected on, like, a doorknob or something as you're walking in, and it rips it out?
That's the worst.
Like, I can't even illustrate the anger that just takes over my body when this earbud gets ripped out and is tangled on something. It happens to me, like, once a month, and it's just...
disorder.
I'm enraged.
Yeah. It's like, I mean, it's like somebody pulling on your head, you know?
Oh, it's like when someone would come up to you in school and flick your ear. Like, who does that? Because it was such a... it doesn't hurt, but then your ear gets, like, red from just the impact of the person's finger.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, you should just jump out of a window right now. It's how mad I would get. People would flick my ear mm-hmm. in school.
Yeah, that would be really annoying.
Did you ever get super angry in your younger youth? Did you ever respond with anger towards somebody, a stranger, to the man who should not be named? You ever get into a fight, Way?
Yeah.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
I think we've talked about this before, but refresh our collective memory.
No, just as a kid, you sometimes get into fights.
Have you punched people?
Yeah.
Yeah? Oh, so you probably came out on top of these.
No.
Oh, no.
Not really. No, just like just little boys, you know?
How little? Under 10?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, probably.
Nah, those aren't fights. It's just like horse and
not on my record. They're at my amateur.
Oh. yeah, they're on your amateur record.
Yeah.
What about high school? Any fights in high school?
No, I don't think so.
I was always...
mellowed out.
But. I was always worried by high school because, I mean, Christ, you hit somebody and it was like, God, go to juvenile hall or something. They really drummed it into you that... fights will not be tolerated at the schools I went to.
You never got into fights in high school?
I got into a handful in like elementary school, but not in high school.
Over what? What would John Pollock get upset about?
I'm talking like 10, 11 at this point. I can't even.
Was it Tamagotchis?
No, that was later. That would have been the 97 boom.
Never got knocked out for killing.
No, it was. I mean, it was always... no guys owned Tamagotchis. It was always girls.
I had a Tamagotchi.
Oh, sorry. Actually, my brother had one, so there you go.
Mm-hmm.
Funny part was after I... that was how I learned of Tamagotchis. Like, my introduction was... I've told this story before. It was just how you reset them at the back, and you could just stick, like, a tiny little object and reset them.
You didn't even know what they were.
No, and then when they explained, like, what I just ruined... I was like, that sounds really cool. Like, you take care of this thing. And I was like, these things are going to be huge.
You just thought these were like little stopwatches and you just saw a button that you decided to hit.
I will be the only stopwatch owner in this school.
Yeah.
And then I ended up, I think I got one at one point. Because those things were, I played magic cards like a motherfucker in that time period when I was like 13. And the place
magic,
I would go to.
Magic fucker.
Yeah. And, it would just be this huge card collectible place that my friends would always go to after school. And then they started, the new thing was Tamagotchis, which started to kind of overtake magic cards in the place. And the owner, Wayne, he was telling me, he's like, Tamagotchis are the new thing. They're going to replace magic cards. So I had already a bit of a disposition towards Tamagotchis. They were edging out my magic cards and that phenomenon. But hey, here we are in 2015. What's more relevant? You go down to the local card store, magic cards still alive and well. Tamagotchis are what? No one's heard of those.
That is true. That is
couldn't
true.
Stand the test of time, could they?
No.
Not enough mana for a Tamagotchi to live off of for all these years.
Yes.
They've just retreated to the Ice Age.
Any more jokes that I'm not going to get?
Nothing. I think I've painted the mirage of what was that 97-98 magic card period.
Okay.
Which is a time period we might backtrack to
maybe
in a coming week.
Maybe.
Are you excited to talk about Daniel Bryan, Journey to WrestleMania 30,
mm-hmm.
not 31?
I was excited, probably more excited maybe a week and a half ago.
You got this one. You got this one out of the way super quick,
mm-hmm.
and then we made the audible last week to do the Dusty Rhodes show.
Yeah.
So you have not watched this in like 2 weeks.
Yeah,
did you have to rewatch it?
No, I just kind of went through my notes again.
It's the best part about having notes,
yeah.
is remembering things.
Because
mm-hmm. I do recall watching this Journey to WrestleMania feature that aired on the WWE Network, but I would not be able to give any level of critique over my when I watched this over a year ago on the network, whenever it aired.
I never watched it back then, and you know, when we decided to do this documentary, I didn't know it was going to be the same one. I don't know if how many people actually did, to be honest with you. I mean, I think some part of the marketing of this documentary, I'm sure, was done to perhaps try to confuse the fact that this was just the network special, but expanded by maybe 9 minutes.
9 minutes were added onto this documentary. Yeah, as soon as we made this selection for a review, we were instantly told by many people that you're essentially reviewing what was on the network, which is fine. But we haven't reviewed that on this show.
Yeah,
I'm fine going back and rewatching this. I mean, it's a very good documentary for what it is.
I'm kind of surprised it took them this long to release this, since that one initially came out not long after WrestleMania 30.
Well, you need to forget it. You need enough time.
Never happened. But, you know, the fact that they also chose not to call it Journey to WrestleMania 30, I probably was intentional as well.
Of course. And I think the expectation level was when they announced a three-disc Daniel Bryan set with a documentary, you assumed you were getting the big Daniel Bryan documentary, which typically you can only do once in the WWE, and they chose not to do it for this one, so I understand that level of expectation was raised, and when people got this, they realized this is largely just a re-release, so to speak, of what they had already gotten on
but,
the
but still cool. I mean, a lot of the bonuses I think were worth talking about. I mean, the documentary itself too, we'll get into.
Yeah, where I think depending on the time of which you watch this, if you watch this when it first aired on the network, I mean, this was a very fresh story. You had just seen the WrestleMania title win, and you fast forward and just a year later, so much has happened with this individual and so little of it in the ring that it almost feels incomplete when this whole story, it doesn't include, outside of one throwaway line by Bryan that he was going into WrestleMania feeling that nerve pain, it's never addressed all the injuries that have mounted up now over the past year, and his career certainly in doubt in 2015. So it's a very interesting story. Daniel Bryan is he's unlike just about anybody, I would say, on the current roster. And when you compare with historical figures who are in his spot as a headliner, I mean, this individual is so different from them. Such an honest look at his own career. I would say almost like underselling himself throughout this, which I'm sure has affected him in his career. That this is someone that, I mean, he's famously told the story that he took this test that all the wrestlers took in the WWE, and he came out as the least ambitious.
Seriously?
Yeah, like they did
like,
this.
Like some type of written test?
This study that they did, and his answers computed to be like he had the least ambition of anybody, because I think he's somebody that looks at himself as just an average individual.
I would love to see these test scores, you know?
I would love to see the questions asked.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds like a match.com type of thing.
Yeah, like what would it be? You're the world champion and you walk into a club and three strippers come up to you and offer their room keys. Would you A, take all three, B, choose one hooker, or C, go back home and call your fiance?
You probably chose C.
Would that constitute a lack of ambition?
Very good question.
So that's why I want to see the questions here before we give a verdict on what the answers actually mean.
Yes.
So, Daniel Bryan, I mean, I guess how did he come across to you throughout this? I mean, he's, I just think, a very honest individual, which is a breath of fresh air, typically in a world, in an environment that just subscribes to exaggeration and often lies and just a bad perception of one's own placement in the grand scheme of things.
You could describe it as honest, but I mean, I kind of took it more as I feel a lot of people come across as honest. Like, I thought Paul Heyman came across honest, but then again, it's Paul Heyman, so he's probably really good at trying to come across honest, even when he might not necessarily be honest. The CM Punk documentary felt very honest.
Wait a minute. Paul Heyman once said on an interview with Jason Agnew he was a big fan of John Pollock. What are you trying to say here?
Well,
are you saying he would have lied?
No, that's gotta be true. But Daniel Bryan here, he definitely comes across honest, but I think what really sticks out about his personality just so, from seeing the interviews was his humility for sure, and almost
awkwardness. Like he feels like awkward about the success he has had.
Almost like humbled to a fault. You know, this is like an industry that clearly demands large egos, and especially at the top, people who, you know, tend to exaggerate and, you know, think more about themselves than they probably actually are. And he's almost the complete opposite. So I think it's amazing how much success he's achieved simply based on his in-ring work. And I'll definitely say it can come across like, you know, his humility has probably held him back at some level.
He describes how he isn't a typical main event guy. Actually, they used a lot of the people they spoke with to kind of convey this. I mean, he wasn't the larger-than-life figure. He didn't have the giant chiseled physique. And in a lot of ways, a lot of the same comparisons that a lot had made with Dusty Rhodes recently passing away, that he didn't fit that particular mold. And both very different performers, Daniel Bryan and Dusty Rhodes, but they excelled in an industry where their body types weren't the norm at all. And we heard from Seth Rollins, John Cena, Cesaro, Brie Bella, William Regal, just amongst the people interviewed. A lot of key people that go beyond just the WWE years with Daniel Bryan. In the case of Regal, all the way back to Memphis when he signed his first developmental deal. Obviously, Cesaro and Rollins going to Ring of Honor. And John Cena, who, as this robot, I mean, at times, like when he goes into a certain mode, like especially talking about the Triple H match coming up with Daniel Bryan, if you can allow me to be candid for a moment, Triple H is a very decisive individual who places a lot of emphasis on legacy. And when legacy is a key, this is the match that they, like, holy Christ, dude, you're on a fucking DVD release here. Like, just, Lay out for
Well, he seems like somebody who, and this even includes Total Divas, he feels like somebody who thinks a lot about what he's about to say before he says it. And, I mean, you know, is he a robot? I don't know. But he's just a guy who thinks a lot about what he says before he says it. And he's very careful with his words.
This weekend, how you doing, man?
I'm doing well.
Yeah?
Yes.
Everything's going okay?
Yes.
Your family's here?
Yes. My mom's here. My sister comes in tonight. So,
very proud of
you. Yeah, thank you very much.
I hope you enjoy tomorrow for everything that it's supposed to be.
Thank you very much.
I mean, this guy, I do not classify as someone that is he is a very charismatic performer. Yeah. But there are certain situations where they'll put him on commentary or something like this, where it's like, I literally believe someone is pressing a button for this Daniel Bryan preview with Triple H match answer. Press the button, and he just, I don't know. I think others just came across a lot more personal than John Cena, who you would think is legitimately close with this guy.
Yeah. Well, John Cena, I think,
I would hope I would have a better answer on the Waiting DVD.
I just think, like, John Cena has probably done so much media that he's just trained to talk a certain way in front of the cameras, and whereas the other people probably come across a bit more less polished in that sense, and therefore more authentic.
Early on in his career, Bryan talked about the inspiration he got from the likes of Dean Malenko and Rey Mysterio in WCW that kind of broke down the size stigma at the time for him. And then on the night he graduated high school in 1999, at the age of 19, he picked up and traveled to Texas to train under Shawn Michaels and Rudy Boy Gonzalez. And that's one of the matches we'll talk about later, when they got a tryout match, which is astounding when you consider it was June of 99 he began training. And by February, he was doing a dark match and getting a developmental deal with the WWE. Like, that's stunning.
And he looked pretty good, man, in that match.
He did. We'll chat about that match. That was something else. A dark match unlike you will ever see.
Yeah.
With some of, and hey, for the short amount of time that Shawn Michaels was a trainer, and a lot of the credit sometimes doesn't go both ways with Rudy Boy Gonzalez, who was a key trainer in that. I mean, that was a hell of a class that they put out, and they had a hell of a success rate of amongst the very small group of which they trained.
Yeah, how exactly did they go about finding people? I mean, you know, it seemed like almost a nationwide search for the best talents.
Well, I mean, this also came at the height of professional wrestling. Shawn was out with his back injury and looking to still keep his name out there and involved in professional wrestling. So he started the Texas Wrestling Academy. And Shawn Michaels, starting a training school to an entire generation that grew up on this guy, mm-hmm. that was a pretty easy decision to make if you're a wrestler like a Bryan Danielson that grew up watching Shawn Michaels. Who would you want to train under? Typically, you would want to learn under the performers that you most enjoyed and excelled at such a high level. So he didn't have a gigantic class, but he had, you know, we'll get into it, the Lance Cade, Brian Kendrick, there was a number of others as well in that time period. Paul London came out of there as well. So you attracted a lot of smaller workers, but I mean, look at the pedigree of what that school produced.
Yeah. And Shawn Michaels himself, you know, is a smaller person.
Yeah. And I think that was also something that Michaels was a great advocate for Bryan Danielson years later when Bryan was starting to get this push and Michaels was someone that certainly went to bat for Danielson. And
how long did that school actually run?
Oh, it was only around for, I would say, 2 years, mm-hmm. something around that.
And how hands-on was Shawn?
I mean, I don't think he was in the ring, like, bumping and stuff because of the nature of his injury. I think that's where they really relied on someone like Gonzalez to be involved with the physical training. But Shawn, from my understanding, I mean, he was there. He was, you know, constantly working with all of these students of his. And for those that have come out of the school, I mean, they've always spoke pretty glowingly of Shawn cool. Michaels.
You know, Shawn Michaels is often sort of on screen, at least cited as, you know, the mentor of Daniel Bryan. But in interviews, you always hear Daniel Bryan talking about how his real mentor is William Regal. And I just find, you know, like, maybe William Regal's not as big of a name, doesn't really fit the narrative as well as, you know, a superstar like Shawn Michaels would. So in features like this, you know, William Regal sort of gets understated, whereas I wonder, you know, the extent to which Shawn Michaels, how much influence he actually had in Daniel Bryan's career.
Yeah, well, I mean, it was also a very short time period when we talk about from June till February, and then he was reassigned to go to Memphis when the WWE had that developmental territory running, and that's where Danielson hooked up with Regal, and yeah, it was a huge influence on him, and, mm-hmm. you know, that's where he got the whole maroon trunks and boots out of, yep. Was being handed down by Regal. And we did hear from Regal throughout this as well and kind of talking about that time period. And we got footage from Ring of Honor and talent from that are currently with the WWE talking about Bryan's history there. And Bryan giving the quote stating, "I truly believe I am not a superstar." And that was, you know, a key line of just kind of where he sees himself in the WWE and how he kind of gave up on ever going to the WWE at a certain point, stopped doing dark matches and velocity tapings for them, realizing he could make good money on the independent level. It was, from an artistic point of view, gratifying for him to be going out mm-hmm. there and wrestling the kind of style he was all over the world and specifically in Ring of Honor, and was very happy with that.
He spoke very highly of the independents here, in particular Ring of Honor, and it just seemed like, you know, at this point in his career, getting to the WWE wasn't even a goal. It was, you know, just being a pro wrestler full-time, making a living at it, and traveling around the world wrestling on the independents, that was already a goal in itself to him, and he had achieved that at a relatively early age. They showed a lot of Ring of Honor footage here, and boy, just awfully improperly white balanced footage, you know, that in contrast to this beautifully shot HD stuff. And I love Ring of Honor, especially like that period of Ring of Honor. But man, like some of the like, and we used to air all that stuff in the Fight Network. So just having to see a lot of that, like there are these classic matches, you know, like Joe versus Punk 2, and I just still remember. And if you watch the tapes now, every camera is like a different color, and it just I think it's sort of a part of a charm of those Ring of Honor tapes, but it's just
to funny, a degree
funny seeing it on the DVD and how like WWE did nothing to try to correct this at all. It's like, showed the shitty looking footage.
Yeah, but that was certainly I felt a bone of contention with Daniel Bryan, where he was brought in and it was very much this narrative of he's been in the minors his whole career, now he's at the majors. And he brought up the fact, yeah, I have wrestled in front of dozens of people. I've also worked the Tokyo Dome. And this idea that there are certain performers where it is the WWE and then everything else is getting you to the WWE. And I think that people like Bryan Danielson looked at this is a business, this is an industry where the WWE certainly has a sizable portion of this industry, but there are styles all over the world and there are offices all over the world that do run, and they are not WWE.
Did he mention that line in the documentary itself or in the interview after?
I can't remember which right. It came in. It okay. May have been on one of the extras.
Because I feel like, I mean, the interviews, the extra bonus interviews that you get after the documentary are really where I think a bulk of the great content is coming from this. I think the documentary itself has some good stuff, but I think a lot of it is shaped under what is an acceptable WWE narrative. But, you know, contrasting this with like the CM Punk documentary, for instance, you don't really get a full glimpse, far from it, of his pre-WWE career. Like on the Punk DVD, there are segments, you know, talking about that Chris Hero feud and showing all that footage in detail. This was really just a short couple-minute section talking about his time in the Independence, where I think in the future, if they do make a more comprehensive Daniel Bryan DVD, I hope more time will be spent on just, his 10 years prior to getting into the WWE.
Yeah, and with the volume of DVDs they put out, I'm sure that's one of the ideas, is not putting everything into this. This was largely a re-release with yep. extra matches, and I think the idea is you can do that entire story at a later date. Because then we just fast-forwarded to NXT and Bryan Danielson signing in 2009. They didn't go through all the problems he had, which is outlined in the Wrestling Road Diaries documentary we've reviewed, of just a lot of the medicals coming back for Danielson, where it was touch and go if he was even going to be signed and pass those medicals, but got in.
So pause the documentary and watch the whole 3-hour Wrestling Road Diaries.
Yes, you'll get quite the extensive look at the final couple of months of Bryan Danielson's independent career before going to the WWE. And didn't really focus on him in Florida Championship Wrestling. It was just right to the NXT show, which mm-hmm. replaced ECW in early 2010. And Bryan Danielson pretty much just talked about his frustrations with NXT and just yeah. the goofy challenges. And they,
I wonder how many people even remember that NXT now, because NXT as a brand is, you know, I mean, it's regarded as the ECW. It truly is the successor to ECW.
Oh, if you hear that song, "We Are Wild and Young," it takes you right back to
this
reality.
This old NXT was just such a. Such a farce, but I mean, I loved it for its train wreck appeal.
And to their credit, I mean, it's not like we had the dissenting view here. I mean, they just enhanced this with shots of Brian turning his head on a bat, juggling. There was an obstacle course.
It honestly played out more like a frat house initiation on TV than any actual type of show. And here you have Daniel Bryan, first of all. I mean, who, when he was announced as being on the show, I think everybody was excited. Oh, he's finally going to make his debut. And then they announced that his pro would be The Miz. And we thought for sure that this was some type of joke.
100%. It was designed for that reaction to infuriate the people that were in love with the American Dragon. But, and who better to put him with than someone that they were going to be disgusted at.
But in hindsight, I mean, It really worked out. It worked out into an automatic feud between the two.
It did.
And it almost set up the Daniel Bryan character throughout his entire WWE tenure, meaning, you know, the office would continually give him these shitty situations. And it was like it almost positioned him as the underdog versus the office from the get-go.
Yeah, but you almost got this defense out of Michael Cole and The Miz that it's like, look at this superstar today, and these were the building blocks of this.
Yeah.
And it's like,
we did
fuck
it.
Off.
We did it. Yeah,
like,
we,
and we, Brian, to his credit, flat out says none of this was designed to get him over. And that, to me, it's the way that certain people will look at that 18-second loss at WrestleMania. It's like, we look at him the next night. It's like, shut up.
Again,
that was never designed for Brian. That was Sheamus's night. And instead, you got a star out of that, and it was the other guy.
Yeah.
Through no help on your own. don't.
So you definitely, like, throughout this whole documentary, there's a lot of reshaping of the scenarios that this guy was put into, as, you know, things that worked out. It just worked out. If not for this, then he wouldn't be as popular as he was.
Yeah, it was just, it was a very narrow view as well, where they talked about the idea that, well, Brian Danielson, everyone knew he was this great worker, but he had no charisma. And to me, that only means you never watched this guy's career, because this guy had tons of charisma that was just, it was never focused upon by you, who just either never watched this guy, or you just heard through word of mouth and associated a stigma that you have placed upon promotions like a Ring of Honor, where the track record of guys that have come over with boatloads of charisma has been pretty damn high.
And it also, I mean, I'm really not surprised to hear some of those responses, because I think at points in this documentary or the DVD itself, you hear about Brian talking about how, you know, people like Vince and even Pat Patterson didn't know that he could wrestle to the extent that he could until this match with Chris Jericho on this episode of NXT.
Yeah, which was the standout on that first episode was, yeah, Chris Jericho was the world champion at the time having a match.
Was it the first episode?
Yeah, it was the very first episode. They did Jericho and Danielson. And, you know, immediately, people were very much upset at A, the fact this guy's being paired with The Miz, and B, the name change. Why does he have to be Daniel Bryan? Which, when we look at the history of name changes, pretty innocent one when you look at it. I've never been one that have got too upset over the names. I think that every time people get upset about a name, like, who cares? Like, are Finn Balor and Hideo Itami, now that we are fully divorced from their debuts, where people took a time to adjust to a new name, has the names hurt them at all? Not in my opinion.
No, not those ones. But I feel like Dolph Ziggler.
Dolph Ziggler is a horrible name, but he is not any less popular because of his name.
Maybe you could be. He's not. You're right. He's
like
not,
he's the
not,
worst
he's
name.
He's not popular because of the push, but he and is just whatever. However, he's been booked. You're right. But I do think certain names will put you in a better spot than others.
So they had a fantastic first match, which the highlight was this suicide dive by Brian onto the announce desk, and Jericho going back after the match and just raving about him to Vince, and Vince just wasn't sold on this guy at all, citing the fact that he doesn't even eat meat as an example. Like,
no, this guy?
Why? And as well, I really liked how they had Pat Patterson involved here, who was sold on him right away. And you could just tell this guy was a big supporter of Danielson and kind of that camp. Which, to Danielson's credit, I mean, as he was ascending the ladder in the WWE, when you have the likes of a Pat Patterson and a Shawn Michaels in your corner, that's some significant weight when it comes to getting behind a guy for those that are on the fence.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure, like, you know, just even through his association with Velocity and his name on the indies, I'm sure he had a really good reputation for being a guy who could wrestle. So it kind of surprised me, though, when, you know, Brian himself mentioned in this documentary that somebody like Pat Patterson didn't know that he could wrestle like this prior to seeing this match.
Yeah, they told this one story of the first time he was supposed to come in was in the summer of 2009 when Brian Kendrick was on SmackDown and he had been teasing a mystery partner, and ultimately, Kendrick ended up getting fired in the midst of it, and Danielson was going to be that partner, and they even brought him in to just cut some promos to show the office that, hey, I can talk, and they ultimately didn't go with him as the partner, but they did, about a month later, offer him his second contract with the WWE, and that's how he came in 2009, went to FCW for a few months, and then was utilized on NXT, so they did give kind of a backstory to that. And then we go to his firing in June of 2010, coming off that great introduction of the Nexus faction, and Brian choking out Justin Roberts with his own tie. And then later that week, an announcement was placed on the WWE website that they have come to terms with the release of Daniel Bryan, and most thought it was a work, but no, in fact, he had violated a major faux pas to choke a man with his tie. And apparently some outside forces came down on the WWE and they were forced to act, and he was gone.
It's just amazing. Like, it's just amazing.
Thank God they weren't sponsors back when Dusty was choking out Superstar Graham.
It's just amazing the obstacles they put themselves through to try to not make money with this guy. You know what I mean? Like, think about all that lost time. The guy's gone now. He's not wrestling any more matches for the foreseeable future. But you had all this time that you could have done so much with him, yet it's all this bullshit that they had to put in front of it.
Well, it was funny because, you know, Brian later was talking about this time period of how he was still making like the bare minimum on his contract at the time. So when he was let go, he had actually at that point, he was making less than he was the year prior on the independents. So when he got his announcement that he was being released, he wasn't too heartbroken about it because I'm coming off this hot angle. I'm this incredibly sympathetic figure who just got fired by the WWE for a bullshit reason. And I'm going to be able to book my entire summer on the independents. He was reaching out to New Japan, which that would have been really interesting if in 2010 he would have hooked up with New Japan. Mm. And that's probably where he would have split his time. And he did great. And then they brought him back in August as the surprise partner for the SummerSlam main event. And then he was right back to obscurity, dating Gail Kim, as the Bella Twins thought that the vegan meant he had never, that he was a virgin.
Which was all conveniently kind of hidden in this document.
Yeah, where was all that?
They just basically went from him coming back at SummerSlam and then going to WrestleMania 30. Or WrestleMania
27.
27, right.
Yes, which was Sheamus. Yeah, the following April, where he was supposed to have a U.S. title match with Sheamus.
Before we get into that, it's important to note that, you know, Cena himself on the Daniel Bryan firing, Cena himself thought it was a little too far, and, you know, he thinks that he should have had some other form of punishment besides a firing.
Yeah, it was certainly an extreme measure they took. But, in, you know, it did set up this return that, you know,
it all worked out. It was perfect.
Like, yeah. Man, they were just brilliant. But I mean, to the argument of let's bring him back for this big return. I mean, just think of that thought process that we've got to bring this guy back. And yet he was back and then he was just throwing down the card. And like, he was never a I almost question, why did you sign him back at that point when you had no plans for him? You weren't sold on this guy.
They tell a story of his coming back and how Patterson was one of the people who, you know, asked to bring Daniel Bryan back for that SummerSlam slot. But it was Vince who actually was fighting against bringing him back. So that kind of tells me that, okay, you know, Vince probably, you know, agreed to putting him in the spot. But, I mean, ultimately, Vince probably still didn't believe in this guy.
It's also worth noting the timing of all this. It was in June 2010 he was released. And it was in June and July, which is when the Paul Heyman talks with TNA had reached their peak. Paul Heyman even publicly acknowledging him being in talks with Spike TV, and that they would be offering him shares in the company to bring him in as the head of creative. And his big plan, which he later revealed, was to bring Kurt Angle and Bryan Danielson as your two key guys. And that would be your big match like a year down the road. But everything would be built around that dream match coming down. So that was his plan.
That would have been awesome. It would have been a way better year than him versus Sheamus.
Instead, TNA got the summer of EV 2.0. In 2010. Hmm. So, you know, trade-off. So Danielson was back in the company by the end of the summer of 2010. And we go to WrestleMania 27, and this is where the day of the show, they found out that him and Sheamus were bumped off the pay-per-view. It was going to be a pre-show lumberjack match. And they had this interview with Brian the day of the show in the stadium where he's just so excited for this big match. And then they interview Sheamus, who calls it the lowest point of his career, when he realized from John Laurinaitis that they were not going to be on the actual pay-per-view.
Hmm.
And, you know, as much as you can look back and just question it, I mean, this was not a hot program at the time. These were not, at least Danielson was not a priority to them at all. And in a weird way, I mean, this did turn into, like, all these incredible sets of circumstances that set up Danielson to become this overly sympathetic figure amongst this base of fans that I believe has grown over the years. And you looked at this as this guy who has been passed over time after time after time after time that resulted in this groundswell for them. And believe me, I give WWE no credit for this.
It all worked out.
It's amazing. Long-term booking at its finest. And that would kind of dovetail into the origin of the Yes chant over the next year. And some of these stories, which Brian would explain in the extras, like such as winning the Money in the Bank came down to the day of, where they were deciding between Cody Rhodes, Wade Barrett, and Brian over who was going to win, and they decided that they wanted Brian to win. They just thought that Barrett winning would be too similar to the other Money in the Bank match and two heels winning, and it came down to a coin flip, and Brian ended up getting it.
It's kind of funny how that... It sounds like that's usually the case, and I wouldn't doubt, you know, like Sheamus winning this year. It was a scenario much different from that.
I can tell you, like, the Sheamus decision was made, like, late in the week. It was not like that was a long-term decision either. I think a lot of these, yeah, it comes down to just... kind of a few days out, or in the case of Brian, the day of, they made this decision. And then it was the idea
that, that title win was really completely glossed over, you know, in this.
It was.
And I think probably on purpose, because you're building to that WrestleMania 30 win.
Yeah, and he mentions the only reason he won that title that year, it was TLC. He wasn't even being brought to the pay-per-views. He wasn't even being flown into them. And he just happened to have an autograph signing close by that day. So they had him, they made the decision, we're going to cash in the Money in the Bank because of the coincidence that Mark Henry got hurt, because they were going to keep the title on Henry. Dude. They drove in Brian.
You remember that Dusty match we reviewed last week, and how that first title wouldn't, I mean, Jesus, like they made it seem like such a historical moment that we even talk about, even, you know, 40 years, 30 years later. And something like that, Daniel Bryan's first WWE title win.
Kevin Nash's quote, the only things that are real in this business, your first title win in the Hall of Fame.
He just happened to be in town.
It was real, December of 2011. So Bryan wins the title, cashing it in on an injured Big Show who had just won it seconds before over Mark Henry. And then they just rode with it into WrestleMania. It was like a complete, like, fluke champion, but then he moved over into the heel Daniel Bryan, introduced the yes chant that he had just seen from Diego Sanchez.
Which he does not attribute to.
No. Maybe, Tony Robbins maybe, and Diego Sanchez got no credit.
Maybe he did, but it was not mentioned on the DVD.
No, it was not. They were probably, who? San Diego? So we go into WrestleMania 28 and the squash match. 18 seconds with Sheamus winning. And I just remember, Wei, you and I at this show, and a half hour before this show, that stadium was chanting yes. It was nuts.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's the finish they had planned for you that night, because this was going to pay 2 years down the road for a title win. This is great. We're planting the seeds.
We're booking for the next day.
Yeah, we're in year number two of our 4-year plan for the Daniel Bryan character.
Oh, it's incredible.
And this whole match was designed to make Sheamus their next big guy. And essentially, he was the Roman Reigns of 2012. He was their big project as a babyface. And the fans were just bummed out. And Brian, the consistent theme throughout this DVD is that he was, to me, the voice of every average fan. Just says, of course they were upset. They were bummed out. They wanted to see a great match for the world title between us two. They got fucked the year before. Now it was our year to have this great... I'm the world champion, for Christ's sake.
The difference is, though, I think you just delivered that with way more anger and intensity than Daniel Bryan ever probably did, you know, backstage. Like, this whole story of him being fucked around by this company, it just begs for just some type of explosion. You know what I mean? Some type of, like, you know, him just freaking out, you know, on Vince, on anybody backstage. But he's just the most calm guy. He just kind of takes all this and he's like, you know what, maybe I'm not a superstar. Maybe I don't deserve it.
And in a lot of ways, I think they test performers like that. In this case, Daniel Bryan was 10-year-old me, and Vince was the guy flicking the ear. And he just see, how many times can I flick it?
Yeah.
And Daniel Bryan's just laughing. That's great form. And just doesn't care. So he keeps doing it. And he just wants him to get up and punch him.
And honestly, like, as a Daniel Bryan fan, that's frustrating. Because I want the hero to come back and slap the evil boss in the face. And he doesn't. He never really gets that.
Yeah. And, you know, the amazing part is the night after Raw, which everyone talks about as this gigantic turning point where the whole arena was going insane, chanting yes. And they show Daniel Bryan addressing the crowd, and Brie mentions how the 18-second match ended up in a weird way making Bryan.
Oh, yeah, this is the turning point.
But let's remember, these geniuses that had this golden plan laid out did not book Daniel Bryan on Raw the next night. He was put in a dark match. So that's the creative part that's kind of glossed over.
Was he even supposed to be in the dark match? So the dark match took place after the show.
Yes, it was after the show.
Was he even supposed to be on that dark match initially, or was that just a call that throughout the show?
I don't know if he was originally set for the dark match or not. Oh, but boy. With this crowd, and you're coming off that show, the idea was, well, we can't put him out in front of the crowd. It's like, and then they wanted to fight the reaction. They didn't want the yes chant. They wanted this guy to be a heel. They then got him to try and chant no, and the crowd just got as vociferous for those reactions coming out, and eventually they just had to go with it. But it's not like this turned Brian. They fought it and tried to push him as a heel coming out of this when he had systematically become the most beloved babyface to this audience. They completely
fought it. It's amazing. No, you don't like this guy. You want to watch our show? No, you don't want to watch it. No, you don't.
The go-to was, okay, you're going to rematch Sheamus at the next pay-per-view, and Sheamus was collateral damage during this time period. And Sheamus has never truly, I won't say recovered, I think he's always been at a certain level that is out of the main event picture, but he's never an innocuous mid-carder. But he's got his role, and even when he had the world title, it was just high mid-card or middle of the mid-card. Yep. That's where this guy's just always been, and I don't see him necessarily ascending to be what they ever envisioned him being as that top, you know, that number two babyface to Cena, which they hoped for in 2012. And an extra during this particular time that was not part of the original network version was Brian sharing a memory of going to a house show with his family featuring the Ultimate Warrior and Rick Rude. And Rick Rude's ass got exposed with his trunks pulled down, and all he remembers is his sister's reaction to the first time she saw a man's bare ass, and says those are the kinds of memories you want to create for people, and that's what he hopes to do, is create memories for people. Bare asses.
Bare asses.
Okay. So this didn't make the cut of the original version, but we had a few more minutes to play with, and this made it.
All the extras, most of the extras on the DVD, most of the extra footage attached to the documentary seemed like it was shot the week of his WrestleMania 30 match, and it seemed to be shot on like a more lower quality handy cam that was just following him around, and they just interspersed that throughout the documentary.
Yeah, at one point they had this incredibly awkward, like, scripted argument with Brian and The Miz backstage that they put into the documentary as if it was this actual disagreement.
It wasn't so much scripted. I think it was just Miz seeing a camera there and just, you know, kind of playing character.
Yeah, it felt like it. Later they showed it, I think, in its entirety afterwards on one of the extras, and it was just like a backstage segment between both very much in their characters.
It was just Miz, like, looking at the mirror, and then Daniel Bryan walking up with the camera, and he's like, what are you doing? And then Miz kind of playing the character. I'll say the more scripted, more awkward one was, like, him talking to Seth Rollins, both angled towards the camera, and then like Seth Rollins.
So, what do you got coming up this week? Oh, I don't know. I'm just in the two biggest matches of my career, and then I'm getting married. It's and I got 100,000 media obligations.
It's just like, you know, producers there, camera guys there, and he's like, you know, why don't you guys talk like you would normally talk?
See, I took it as like both as like a wink wink of like, we are clearly being told to do this, and I feel most of you will realize that.
And then like at some point, Seth Rollins and Daniel Bryan are just like, okay, is that enough? You got it? Okay.
I don't care what he's doing this week. Then they showed the yes reactions translating into other sports environments, in particular a Michigan State basketball game, which it was quite an impressive visual. And amazingly, you know, they kind of disregarded their own audience, but when it would cross over into mainstream sports, it's like the WWE is just in awe of this. And it's like, those are the kinds of things that change their mindset. It's a very interesting from a company that so loves to push that we give the audience what they want. Yeah, just not your audience, the other people's audiences. Mm. So I know I'm being very hypercritical here.
No, I
find this documentary.
I think somebody needs to be. I thought you know, this documentary, it definitely has a WWE slant to it.
I just feel like this, if you're a normal individual that doesn't follow wrestling and you watch this, I don't know how you come to a conclusion that this is a company that was just so out of touch on so many levels with this performer who got over beyond anyone's expectation, and it's a complete mystery that this guy was able to overcome all of this because everything was thrown in front of him to fail, and somehow he didn't at the end of this, and it was by no help of the organization that defines itself as a promotional entity.
And I don't think the documentary itself was critical enough of the company's poor booking decisions, you know?
Yeah, I felt Brian was kind of the only one who would point out certain things. And from those that have seen his book, it seems like he elaborates a lot more on this and goes into detail with his own thoughts. And critical of Michael Cole's commentary, stating that he doesn't believe that's how you build a star. Cole came from the opposite notion. And, you know, I didn't think it really helped Brian at all. I mean, it certainly created a certain sympathy level, but it was like he was discarded as a geek.
Yep.
That's how it was in 2010. It's not like this was this burgeoning superstar that was going to overcome this heel and who was aligned with The Miz. It was like that did no favors for him by the time that feud was wrapped up. And we also got this awkward conversation on the street with Jack Swagger asking Daniel Bryan about his Seattle Seahawks shirt. And he's like, how many of those shirts do you own? And Bryan's like, I own 100 of these shirts. And it was just like, what a random conversation with Jack Swagger. Like, how do you not throw up from wearing that same shirt day after day after day? Like, oh my God, don't allow this man to ever speak.
I like your Jack Swagger lisp.
I try.
It's pretty good.
It was just the most, like, that to me was like every producer laughed at this clip of Jack Swagger trying to improv. And we got to put this in there.
Yeah, yeah.
A great demonstration of why Jack Swagger had a mouthpiece. Maybe the most telling quote of this entire documentary was Brian saying, as he's preparing for WrestleMania and doing this massage therapy, I've been fortunate. I haven't had many injuries.
Mm.
And describes how most of his injuries have been shoulder-related, including separating his shoulder moments into a 2 out of 3 falls match with Colt Cabana, and they had to go an hour, which... 9 times out of 10, when a wrestler says something like that, and we had to go an hour, they're bullshitting by an extreme amount of time. Legitimate 60-minute match he had with Colt Cabana in August of 2006.
Mm.
So we don't really go into anything after WrestleMania regarding his injuries, but the rest of this was kind of preparing for WrestleMania, the angles to set it up, the Occupy Raw segment. And quite a bit focused on the Royal Rumble that year, the first of 2 Royal Rumble disasters, back-to-back years, and Brian saying everything that any fan would have said the night of that Rumble, that it was just such a slap in the face to the fans who were never made aware Brian was not going to be in the Royal Rumble. He was put in a singles match to start off the show where he lost to Bray Wyatt. And then when the number 30th entrant came out, it was Rey Mysterio. And when they realized there's no Brian in this Rumble, they turned on that match so fiercely. And it was a disaster of a match.
Mm-hmm.
And it was still at that point, he had no significant plans for WrestleMania. He outlines the fact that Vince called him in to go over his WrestleMania plans, and he was thinking perhaps it's going to be Triple H because of everything they've been doing on television with the Authority, or Shawn Michaels because of the tease they did at Hell in a Cell where Michaels laid him out with a super kick, and maybe Shawn is going to come back and the mentor-student match will take place at WrestleMania. And instead, Vince sat him down and said, you've got Sheamus at WrestleMania. Like, this was just the punchline to a joke. Like, you've got Sheamus again. And it was just, again, as late as January of 2014, it was still not in the plans to do anything. And I always go back to that horrible pay-per-view, that Battleground show. I don't know if you watched that show or not, but it was Daniel Bryan and Randy Orton. And the match ended with Big Show coming down and attacking Bryan. And it just ended...
This was after SummerSlam?
This was after SummerSlam, when Orton and Bryan had a number of pay-per-views together.
After he won the title. After Bryan briefly won the title and
They did the cash-in. Yeah. Then the following month, Bryan won it, and they switched it the night before and did the dusty finish. Then they did Battleground, and they left you with no finish. It sucked.
Oh, there was a whole series of shows after that when it was just so clear that Daniel Bryan was the one and only option that they should have gone through.
It was plain as day.
Yeah.
And I remember after that Battleground show, there was anger throughout people watching that show. And I remember Road Dogg tweeting, wait until the story plays out. And that has become the ultimate crutch of bad creative. And we can look in hindsight now at that comment as being utter bullshit, because the story was supposed to climax in Daniel Bryan joining the Wyatt family and taking on Sheamus at WrestleMania. There was no conquering the villain in sight for Daniel Bryan. So had we waited for the story to play out as it was planned at that point, everyone should have been disappointed, because they had no redemption program for Daniel Bryan to get his comeuppance. But then Bryan outlined the series of events that changed WrestleMania. He said, namely, Batista came back and everyone fucking hated him, and there was no way they could headline with Orton and Batista, which Vince McMahon had stated was going to be the biggest main event in WrestleMania history.
I really wish they interviewed you for this documentary, John, because, like, you sound so much angrier, and you're able to, like, talk about this bullshit, like, in a way more satisfying way than I got from this documentary, because I just, like, throughout this, it just seemed like Daniel Bryan would talk about it, but he definitely didn't seem that upset about it. And also, the documentary also kind of glossed over a lot of those specific points about just how much this guy was screwed around with. And I really think that is the story. The story is how this guy overcame terrible booking to, you know, ultimately get into the main event in WrestleMania and win the main event in WrestleMania because of the fan reaction. I don't think that was really told as well as, you know, you're doing right now.
Daniel Bryan needs an advocate. That's what he needs. And then the second biggest change that forced them to reshuffle the deck for WrestleMania was, of course, CM Punk walking out the night after the Royal Rumble that year. So you had Batista and Orton that they didn't feel confident promoting as a singles match, despite them trying their best to just get Batista out of certain cities. And B, Punk was scheduled to get Triple H at WrestleMania. So now you had the only logical choice in Daniel Bryan, who was now going to be inserted to take on Triple H and then go on to win the title at WrestleMania. And seeing how everything was laid out, I mean, it really was a miracle that everything happened the way it did, that Batista got a reaction like he did, and they just realized this was not going to dissipate going into WrestleMania, and the wild card of Punk walking out on them. Mm-hmm. Created these two openings, but it would have been Daniel Bryan Sheamus probably on the kickoff show, potentially. And then it's essentially everything is put in place for WrestleMania. We get a lot on Bryan preparing for his wedding, which is going to be the Friday after WrestleMania. I don't know how he planned this.
They talk. There's a brief section on here about his relationship with Brie. They talk about how, you know, these two were actually together even before Bryan was on booked, you know, constantly on the card in 2011, and just a little brief segment. I will say a lot of this, the moments that they capture with the two of them together are very cute, very cute.
I will say this: I know that a lot of people don't enjoy the Bellas, but whenever I see them outside of WWE programming, this being an example, the earlier seasons of Total Divas, I can't say I watch the later seasons, they, to me, have always had personality, and they have always, there is a...
Well, they're not being told to act.
They're horrible actresses.
Yeah, they're not very good actresses, and, I mean, I think Brie, in like certain, you know, of these moments, like, she seems like a great person. Like, she just, I have no doubt she is a great person. But for some reason, when she talks on camera, she just doesn't come across as very likable. And that includes a lot of these interview segments on this documentary where, you know, you talk about John Cena sounding rehearsed. I think Brie Bella is unable to sound genuine, even when talking about her husband, unfortunately. It's just something about the quality. But, you know, you see them when they're just interacting, when she's just, you know, talking to Bryan as they're getting out of the elevator, poking fun at how short Bryan is. Like, moments like that, I think, you know, are incredibly sweet and genuine.
And the documentary, it finishes off clearly with WrestleMania, the big title win. And as Daniel Bryan had noted, you know, feeling this pain in his arm, this nerve issue that he's having, didn't prevent him from taking a powerbomb into a reverse neck breaker on an announce desk during the final match at WrestleMania, which I understand it's the main event of WrestleMania, but if that was not a precursor to what we would see accentuated the following year when he came back, and I'll say reckless style that Daniel Bryan implemented during that comeback, I mean, this was a guy that I think didn't give his body what it needed. He trusted himself, and that to me was a grave issue in what he's currently dealing with now. This belief that he was just invincible to take these ridiculous Luke Harper full Nelson slams onto his neck and stuff like this, that it's compounded into a career that's very much in jeopardy now.
Sure. You know, they recap the WrestleMania matches, but they, of course, neglect to mention the whole Undertaker loss. I mean, I just remember watching that whole show live, and I mean, I think we're all looking forward to the Daniel Bryan matches and seeing this moment of Daniel Bryan winning the title, but I just remember the whole mood in that arena was just so dulled after that Undertaker loss that I think it definitely changed the reaction, in my opinion.
It was, pardon the pun, a funeral for that Divas match that followed it. And you had that brief buffer match, and then, yeah, you had the main event that essentially had to follow the most famous finish, I would say, of since 97 for the WWF.
And unfortunately, that was also the climax that they decided to use for this documentary. And, you know, this documentary was able to clean up and rewrite history a little bit cleaner. You know, oh, this was a babyface triumphant after everything. And reality just definitely didn't play out like how this documentary played.
Yep, and they didn't go into any of the post-WrestleMania issues, vacating the title, the comeback earlier this year, brief comeback at that, and then, you know, the second go-around with his problems, which are very much speculated upon because they've never flat-out said what the issues are, and that kind of brought into the topic this recent interview Bret Hart did over the past week with Sports Illustrated, where he believes Daniel Bryan's career is done and didn't flat out say it was a concussion, but very much related it to his own injuries towards the end of his active career in WCW, where he suffered the initial concussion against Bill Goldberg at Starrcade, continued to work and suffered further damage, and that ultimately ended his career, save for that brief little 2010 run in the WWE, but kind of hinting that those are the issues Bryan's facing. So, you know, you compound that with the neck problems and a possible concussion issue on top of that. It's a scary picture for Daniel Bryan, and if he will continue at this point where there doesn't seem to be any timetable on a return.
Mm-hmm. That's unfortunate, but I guess you could also look at it like, you know, his body could have failed him years ago doing that type of style, and maybe he's lucky to have even had this run that he's had.
Yeah. So that was the look at the documentary portion. Again, if you had seen the Journey to WrestleMania special, largely the same, save for 9 minutes.
Same thing, 9 minutes. The 9 minutes are really mostly skippable stuff. I mean, some scenes were certainly...
Rick Rude's bare ass, come on. They literally bared all for these.
Some scenes are extended, but largely it's just scenes of you know, him like talking about how he figured out a way to pack your protein inside your gym bag.
I didn't know that.
Use tape.
Do you do that?
I don't pack protein.
Oh, okay.
And he, you know, things about how, what else does he talk about? Bree talking about how uncomfortable he is bragging. I mean, just
refused to have a magazine article on Bryan placed in his home and hung up by Bree.
Yeah. We get to see Bryan take an RMT appointment. Like, just nothing that's really worth the 9 minutes. What is worth the your extra time, if you've already seen the network special, is the extra set of interviews that take place after the release of the documentary. So, clearly, you know, they shot a bunch of interviews for the documentary, but they re-interviewed Bryan at some point after the documentary was released. And they used a lot of these interviews to tee up the matches that were all the bonus features on this documentary.
Yeah, and Wei and I watched a few of these matches, starting off with the tryout match they received in February of 2000 in Austin, Texas, which is interesting that I point out because Bryan noted that this interview they were conducting at that point was in the same arena where that tryout match took place in 2000. And it was Bryan Danielson and Shooter Schultz taking on the late Lance Cade and a very tiny Brian Kendrick. And
this is Bryan Danielson masked as the American.
Yes, Dragon. Yeah, he was masked at the time. And he told this great story about how they were going to be given something like 15 minutes, and then they got their time cut down to 6 with entrances, and Michaels just throwing a gasket. This was, of course, Shawn Michaels of 2000, and just saying, you go out there and do whatever you want, and just pushing their mm-hmm. guys to just go out there. And Danielson kind of reflects on this match, like, they broke essentially every rule you could. If you are an aspiring WWE wrestler that has been given a dark match tryout, never watch this match. You should never do what these four did, because they broke every possible rule you could that is going to infuriate the people grading you and offering you a job.
They pretty much went out and had an indie level main event as the dark match, like before the heat tapings.
This was totally it. They did stuff in here that was just nuts. I mean, we had this. I'll run through some of the highlights of the match. This thing, they ended up going just over 11 minutes. So I guess a compromise between what Sean wanted.
It was only 11 minutes?
This was 11
it
minutes.
Felt way, it
well,
felt like,
they packed
felt like,
25 minutes into these
it
11.
It felt like a 20-minute match.
I mean, there was this huge tope by Kendrick to Schultz on the floor, and then Cade hit a clothesline off the top to Schultz. Schultz hit a reverse DVD to Kendrick. They got this long heat spot on Brian Kendrick. Kendrick finally hits a brainbuster to Danielson before tagging in Cade, who dumped both men to the floor. And Kendrick would proceed with a springboard crossbody, followed by Cade with a tope to the floor, followed by Danielson with a somersault dive off the top to Cade, and then Schultz powerbombing Kendrick on the top turnbuckle, and then pulling him to the floor to break the cover. Why not? We have a dragon suplex delivered by the aforementioned American Dragon to Brian Kendrick. And then Cade, just for shits, choke slams Brian Danielson. Tornado DDT off the top by Kendrick to Schultz. Slam by Cade, and Kendrick with a frog splash just mere 1 week, so to speak, after Eddie Guerrero debuted to cover Danielson at 11:21.
Yeah, it really was incredible.
Like, if these dudes came in here without Shawn Michaels, you would have never heard from these four again, I feel.
Oh, no way. I mean...
To be honest, though, of what the WWF was looking at, I can only imagine they paid any attention to Lance Cade.
Who was definitely the most green of all the people. I was really surprised to learn that, you know, this was them only 4 months in. And I have a hard time believing that, because Brian was pulling off a lot. Like, Brian and Kendrick, they looked very good, you know. Not as good as, obviously, they would go on to be. But, like, Brian was pulling off a lot of moves that he still uses today, like the surfboard. A lot of things that I mean, you watch, and it's hard to believe that, you know, this guy probably had... He probably had a bit of training and experience before this. But Lance Cade definitely looked the most green of all of them.
The only other match I watched was the Velocity match they put on here from January of 2003. So this was after he had been released the first time, against Jamie Noble in East Rutherford, New Jersey. And Josh Matthews and Ernest Miller were on commentary.
Mm-hmm.
They were very excited about the Royal Rumble the next night.
Yeah, this was fun. It was funny listening to the commentary at the time, because Josh would, like, in the middle of this match, talk about Tori Wilson being sad about her dad's death.
Yeah, Al Wilson had just passed along.
It was very funny. I thought Josh actually did a good job at this time.
He noted Danielson, same hometown as Kurt Cobain.
Yeah, and he was able to call a lot of, you know, the Japanese moves that Brian was doing. Ernest Miller, not so much. Never a fan of his.
Gave quite a bit of offense to Danielson, and they got some time. They just went over 6 minutes. The finish was a spinning forearm to the back of the head, and then Danielson hit this bridging German for Noble to kick out of, and then Noble introduced a spinning neck breaker to pin Danielson.
This was, what, 2003?
Yes.
And, I mean, I'm sure there's so many nuances that I probably didn't pick up on, but really, watching this Brian Danielson, he seemed every bit as good as the Daniel Bryan that we saw today. You know, he seemed really good at this point. And this match is available, you know, at a variety of sources that I think people can watch. But it was really cool. It was an intense match. I remember Velocity at the time really being, you know, despite one of the pre SmackDown taping shows, it really was a show that I went out of my way to watch every single week, because it would feature guys like Brian Danielson or a Brian Kendrick in appearances before they were actually signed. So this was fun.
Yeah, Velocity was a fun show to watch if you were a fan outside of the WWE, because they would routinely bring in, Samoa Joe. Low key, you might see some weeks. I mean, they would bring in a lot of different independent talent at times, and you know, you got to see a Bryan Danielson John Cena match from 2003 mm-hmm. with John Cena's big yellow pants.
Things that make for great DVD extras.
Yeah.
Later. That John Cena match is also included here, but only on the Blu-ray. On the Blu-ray disc, there are a bunch of extra matches, too.
What a loss.
So, I mean, you know, the fact that they released pretty much his entire WWE wrestling career in this set makes me question if they have any other plans to make an extra DVD for this guy or an extra documentary for this guy in the near future. It could be years down the line before we get another set, I think.
Yeah. Were there any other matches you watched?
No,
those
not really.
I watched
the Daniel Bryan Jericho match, I think, was also notable. But you know, it's this plus all of his pretty much any of his WWE highlights are included on this set. No independents.
Just some other notes from the extras, including Daniel Bryan's intros to a lot of these matches, which included a lot of interesting notes. He mentioned the Money in the Bank win he had in 2011. Which, if you recall, that was the big Money in the Bank show with John Cena and CM Punk and just the decision the day of. And then that went into the title change in December. Again, a very last-minute decision. He went through all of the stuff with Sheamus. And just a level of honesty you don't typically get, because they talked about WrestleMania 28. And then they had a rematch the following month at Extreme Rules, which was a 2 out of 3 falls match that Sheamus says stole the show. And they go back to Brian, and he just kind of laughs and says, I would love to say it stole the show, but everyone knows that Brock Lesnar and John Cena really did steal the show that night. Like, just, he has a level of honesty where he feels like, I'm not going to bullshit anybody and overstate anything. And he was right. I mean, Cena and Lesnar was the match on that particular show. And it's just, it's very refreshing, I find, in professional wrestling for somebody to have that level of self-awareness. And to your point, though, almost maybe too critical of himself.
Yeah.
Some other things here. He mentioned a match with CM Punk at Over the Limit in 2012, where he came out in this green military jacket, and he was trying to push this idea that he was turning into an anarchist, very much like Eric Young.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, Eric Young, the whole title change he had last year was very much reminiscent of the Bryan push.
I completely forgot about this one appearance by this...
I had no recollection of this military jacket.
This taxi driver-inspired military jacket. He came out. He talks about how he came out with it once, and then Vince said, who allowed this?
Yeah, he immediately relayed to Bryan to take that jacket off, and Dean Malenko got chewed out in the back for allowing that jacket to be worn in the first place. And then talked about the feud with Kane and then eventually teaming together. It was supposed to be 1 month of the two teaming, and it grew into be much more. And talking about the anger management skits, the hug segment, and doing a lot for Bryan. I thought that was a kind of a key growth period for him as a personality to many people that were not familiar with him at that point and had very good chemistry with Kane. And then mentioned the match with John Cena, which was the headliner at SummerSlam that year. He said he was honored to be in the main event, noted he wasn't even the main event for that aforementioned match with CM Punk at Over the Limit or at Money in the Bank, but then also brings up, and this again, one of the few wrestlers is going to do, he said that year's SummerSlam, it didn't draw that well with Cena and Bryan in the main event. And he is true. I mean, that show did 332,000 buys. It was down significantly from the prior year, which was Lesnar and Hunter, which was a more successful program. I would say that SummerSlam, it was very much promoted as that match and Lesnar Punk. And, you know, it was down. There's no way to really spin that number other than less people were interested in that, in those two matches than they were Lesnar Hunter the prior year. But just, it's very bizarre to hear a wrestler acknowledge that he was in a program that the public didn't respond to at the level anticipated.
I think it's definitely him being honest, but again, I think he almost feels comfortable accepting the failure so that he doesn't have to bear the responsibility of being a top guy like a John Cena or something. I think like Daniel Bryan definitely comes across as somebody who, you know, will accept the facts that people tell him instead of your typical response from a main eventer who will come up with an excuse. Here, he almost seems willing to accept the failure. So, it's interesting.
What do you give this entire, I guess, DVD set, rather than just a documentary with the extras included.
The extras are kind of buried in there, you know, like, really, the documentary itself, I give it maybe a 6 out of 10. I think a lot of it is not, it's well done, of course, but it's not entirely, comprehensive nor truthful, in my opinion, which is what I think you'll expect from a lot of network specials and WWE produced things. I really do think the best features of this documentary, for people who especially have seen the documentary already on the network, are these extra interviews leading up to these bonus matches. Overall, I mean, I give it a 7 out of 10. Maybe 7. Yeah, 7 out of 10. Far from, you know, some of the great DVDs of recently released, like that Paul Heyman one or the CM Punk one or even the Dusty one.
Yeah, I'd go a 6 out of 10 on this particular release from the WWE. I thought Brian was... the highlight throughout this. I thought he provided a lot of good context, but I still wanted a bit more, and I think the book will provide that. But certainly you were left wanting from this. I think this was very much just putting a lot together and glossing over a lot. It's a really fascinating story with this guy, and I think fully telling that story, it's more an indictment than a, you know, congratulatory one for the WWE that this guy got to that height that he did. Okay, we'll go over now to the Law message board and hear what you had to say. And we'll start off with Tanise. Really, this was the Mania special with extra clips, but it still had the same effect on me. It told the story of a guy who had a passion to be a pro wrestler and nothing more. It is that same passion that has led him to go down as a legend and an all-time great, in my opinion. Mainly, I love this documentary because you truly get the feel that Bryan Danielson is the nicest and most genuine person ever. And that's something because, let's be honest, there's lots of assholes in the wrestling business. Just hearing him talk about not thinking of himself as a star, getting nervous around people wanting his autograph, and always thinking about those who didn't get their big break while ready for Mania matches speaks volumes to his character. One minor complaint is I would have loved to have heard Vince give his opinions on Brian. Other than that, a 10 out of 10 for me. For matches, this man has such an excellent body of work, it's hard to choose what my favorite one is. What pops into my head is his match with Shingo after he got fired, his first match with Takeshi Morishima, and the infamous headlock match with Claudio Castagnoli for Pro Wrestling Guerrilla.
I would have loved to have a little bit in the documentary about that match, like a bit of a behind the scenes about that.
The headlock match.
These two.
Well, I don't know if this was the case or not, but there was a match in 1994 with Dick Murdoch and Bullet Bob Armstrong where they did, I haven't seen the match, it's a 23-minute headlock spot. Wow. And I don't know if that was their influence for that particular match in 2006, but it was, I love that match. Yeah. I thought it was great. And we've reviewed that one with Todd Martin if you want to go back into the archives.
We go to Danny Hernandez from Dallas, Texas, who says, to get the definitive look at the career of Brian from Independence to Mania to Main Event, I recommend, before starting the doc on the DVD, to find the first Wrestling Road Diaries. There is a scene where Colt, Sal, and Brian go visit Brian's sister, who was pregnant at the time, with the little girl who Brian hugged after winning the WWE title at Mania 30. Now, doesn't that warm your heart?
Mick Whalen. If you are looking for a typical WWE documentary chronicling Daniel Bryan's career, then you bought the wrong DVD. The WrestleMania special is good stuff and does go into some detail about Bryan's ups and downs in his career. That said, it does not compare to a far more in-depth career documentary like CM Punk or Bret Hart. The newer WWE documentary style of segment match just doesn't appeal to me as much. I just described WWE TV in a nutshell. The matches are very good with some essentials like Bryan and Triple H from WrestleMania 30 missing. The Blu-ray stories are the best part of the extras as Bryan goes into further detail about his career. The Blu-ray matches are nothing special except for the Velocity match with John Cena, who has some of the most hilarious generic rap music I have ever heard as his theme, and the Cage Showdown with Bray Wyatt. I get the feeling that this will not be the last DVD on Bryan, and that a more complete documentary will be in the pipeline in the future. If you want a more in-depth look at Bryan's career, get his autobiography, which should be out pretty soon. The Blu-ray gets an 8 out of 10. There are some great matches, but the biography is somewhat bare bones, in my opinion.
Yeah, we should mention that the Blu-ray includes those extra matches, plus an extra set of interviews and stories from Bryan himself. So do check that out. We go to Gonzalo from Minneapolis. I wish they could have covered Brian's ROH career a bit more like they did with Punk. Not too long ago, Dave Meltzer said that between Punk and Brian, Punk was a successful WWE main eventer while Brian was more successful in the indies. John, do you know if Brian ever did the G1 for New Japan, and if he did, how successful he did?
He didn't do the G1. I mean, he was pretty much exclusive to their junior heavyweight division and didn't do the G1 any of the years he was affiliated with New Japan. Alex from Plymouth. I always thought Daniel Bryan was always disliked by Triple H, thus the reason he was always buried by Sheamus in 2012 by jobbing to him every match they had. I find that win over Triple H not as a major moment, considering it was forgotten at the end of the night and not really being made. Do you guys think he would have been the AJ Styles of 2010 if he never went back to WWE and signed with New Japan? It's a hypothetical. You know, Bryan Danielson, he was involved in a lot, including, you know, when Gabe Sapolsky came up with the concept of Evolve, it was Daniel Bryan who he had earmarked as his top star before Danielson signed with the WWE. And then in 2010, he, you know, that was Heyman's project if he had gone to TNA. And New Japan, I think, certainly would have been, that would have been Danielson. I think he would have easily gone back to New Japan and would have been a key during their growth period, especially into 2012 and beyond. I don't know if at that time period he would have been able to jump into the heavyweight division, which I think it's a bit more open now with AJ Styles in that particular division. But it's an interesting theoretical question, but I think he certainly would have been doing a lot with New Japan over the past few years if he had gone back there.
We go to Matt Terry, who says, I really enjoyed this doc when it first came out last year on the network. I thought it did a great job of telling the story of Bryan's career against the backdrop of the WrestleMania main event. WWE can make great shows with this documentary format, with the Balor segment from NXT last week, as well as last year's Shield documentary being two recent examples. How would you guys feel about the documentary style having a greater presence on the weekly Raw and SmackDown shows? The current WWE format is so outdated for the most part, I think a change is needed. Plus, I feel the style of storytelling is the best way to tell stories and build characters, much like a UFC countdown show. I don't understand why WWE continued to rely on a format straight out of 1997. That Finn Balor thing on NXT I thought was tremendous. Same with the Hideo Itami thing they did after WrestleMania. And I totally agree with Matt Terry here, who when you say, you know, documentaries, I think are just the best way to get guys over.
I think that that's one of the great promotional tools the WWE has. And I think that's one thing that largely is underappreciated are the kinds of stories and personalities that some of these guys possess on the main roster that a lot of people have no clue about. And I think that just taking a couple minutes out of Raw to tell some of those stories, to get guys across as more multidimensional than they appear most weeks on television. I mean, I don't want to watch a 3-hour show that is just wrestling in the ring. I want variety. I want interviews. I want promos. I want profiles, vignettes, yeah, and quality and stuff that is going to enhance some of these characters so the matches do have their biggest impact. I think that a lot can be learned from that lesson of just how easy, not easy to put together, but how effective that Finn Balor piece was as one example.
In particular, I think it's a format that is more conducive to building baby faces because they make the subject so, you know, typically relatable. Although we've seen, you know, like they've been able to do things with like a Brock Lesnar that have been, you know, great for his heel character. They're not really in the documentary style, but I mean, obviously you watch a UFC Countdown special too and you could build heels with this format as well.
Frank Mir.
Yeah, totally. So, I mean, I think
like, look at a guy like Sheamus, who I guarantee you, if you were to, like, a Wade Barrett or a Sheamus, who I know they have compelling stories, yep, that this audience that has only seen them in the WWE would have no clue about their background and their struggle to finally get signed and what they've gone through. I mean, that's never illustrated. And yeah, there's a certain way to do it if you're talking about two heels in the case of Barrett or Sheamus. But I think that Sheamus, he's a perfect example of someone that, going back to 2009, how much do you know about this guy?
Mm-hmm.
He's a jolly Irish guy.
I think, I mean, and this goes, you know, goes to I guess, champion the newer formats like these documentaries or podcasts, where you get to see a more honest glimpse of these guys that I think are so often we just see them read off of a script and play a character that's created for them rather than, you know, them being themselves or at least a version of themselves that, you know, I think is these days, I think audiences are a lot more understandable of, you know.
Well, that will wrap things up for this week's show and a look at the Daniel Bryan Just Say Yes, Yes, Yes DVD Blu-ray. Next week on the show, Mr. Ting, it is Canada Day.
That is right. And we this request actually comes from our unofficial coffee sponsor.
Oh, that's right.
Our unofficial coffee sponsor.
He can be official.
Let's make him official. Okay. Our official coffee sponsor of Review Away, Brad. Brad from the board. Kind enough to shoot us some Tim Hortons via email. So thank you, Brad.
We very much appreciate it.
And he's asked that in honor of Canada Day next week, July 1st, we do something Canadian-related. And what is the show that we're going to do?
A card from Fresno, California.
Okay.
But why does it tie in with Canada? Because that is the pay-per-view that, in addition to Sable's breasts being covered with finger paint, also featured the dungeon match from Calgary, Alberta, involving Owen Hart and the recently defeated Ken Shamrock, which was taped in Calgary and aired on the pay-per-view.
One of the great Canadian moments in WWE history.
One of the greatest Canadian moments in Canadian history, I think you could argue.
Yeah, I think they're going to make a Heritage Moments short about it.
So we are going to review that. There is a tag match that headlines the show with Steve Austin and The Undertaker against Kane and Mankind. There is a 2 out of 3 falls match with Triple H and The Rock. Lots of stuff that we are going to be chatting about next week as we review WWF Fully Loaded 1998. Mm-hmm. It's not half full. It's not three quarters full. It's fully loaded next week.
What exactly is loaded?
It means it's a holiday next Wednesday, so that means you can all get loaded at home, download the show, and hear me and Wei.
You can fully download it.
You can fully download, fully loaded. And you don't even need to fully upload this pay-per-view to watch it because it's available on the WWE Network.
Okay.
So that's going to wrap things up. That is how we are going to end the show. We are going to chat with you all later this week. All our regular slate of shows will be out. I don't think I have to remind you all. You can subscribe on iTunes. You can listen at the website. You can follow Wei at Wei0937. He follows about 6 people.
I'm a lot more now. I follow everybody now.
Oh, you've made quite the turn.
Changed my stance. Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's wonderful. Will you follow any listeners if they tweet you and ask?
Probably not.
Okay. Well, be forewarned. Wei is very selective, but he's more open than he was 6 months ago.
How's your muting going?
Wonderful.
Yeah?
I love it.
John will actually screenshot his mutes, and he'll send them to me to show me who he's about to mute.
As I laugh maniacally in the air.
He's kind of sick.
Okay. That's going to wrap things up, folks. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll chat with you next week for Fully Loaded.
Do you have another shirt besides that, or do you just wash that every night?
No, I have 17 different Seahawks shirts because we're the Super Bowl champions.
How do you wear those without throwing up every time you put it on? Do you get like a nauseated feeling in your stomach?
We dominated every game we were a part of. When we played the 49ers, how many interceptions did we get?
I blanked out.
Yeah, so many that you can't even count.
Listen.